Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Rebecca Harrison, who's a lecturer in theatre, film and television studies at the University of Glasgow, about her new book, The Empire Strikes Back, which is published as part of the BFI Classics series. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
And I promise you this will be my only pun, this is an impressive, most impressive book about The Empire Strikes Back, both in terms of introducing the film, kind of setting it in its historical and contemporary context, but also I think, offering a kind of a challenge to what we might think of the film and maybe, you know, some kind of interest in revisions. And I guess the place to start is how you came to write this book, why you were sort of interested in this, and particularly actually why you're interested in writing this I suppose scholarly edition about this famous film.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for the kind words about it. I've actually been more nervous about the publication of this than I think anything else I've ever written, in part because it is taking this, I think you said, you know, kind of, it is a revisionist take on the film and on the franchise. So I was starting a project, a much bigger project about Star Wars from an academic perspective that should lead to a much bigger book that looks at the whole franchise and will think more about some of the paratext outside of the films, including the games and what they've done with the fairground attractions and things like theme parks. Couldn't think of the word there. So things like that as well, and some of the TV shows. And that is about more about technology and how Star Wars, the Star Wars franchise through Lucasfilm and Industrial Light and Magic, has kind of pioneered digital technology, but not just thinking about it as an aesthetic thing, but which is what we tend to do in film and media studies, but to think about the implications of that through production, distribution, exhibition, in terms of labor practices and who is making these films and how they're being made and so on. And that's due to come out in, I think, 2024, I think. I should know that. So I was already working on that project and have a contract with Bloomsbury for the book that will come out of it. So I'd already been kind of talking about this new project on Star Wars a bit online. And I also kind of moonlight as a film critic and culture writer. So I had done some shorter, more general audience writing on Star Wars that had come out. And then I was contacted by the editor at Bloomsbury, who is in charge of the BFI Film Classics list. And that was Rebecca Barden, and she asked me if I would be interested in writing something on The Empire Strikes Back because the 40th anniversary of the film was coming up. Obviously, that was this year, back in May. So then really it was just a case of sitting down and thinking about whether or not I had something new to say about this particular film, which I have loved dearly since childhood. And it's probably my all-time favorite Star Wars film, I think. But yeah, there's so much out there that's already been said. So it was really just a case of, you know, am I the right person to say this? And do I have something to say? Which I hope it comes across that I have. But it was, in the end, it just ended up being a really exciting, fun project to work on.
I mean, that totally shines through in the book, actually. And you know, the book is an incredibly easy read, both in terms of kind of going through it. Like, you know, it's rare any kind of academic analysis is a sort of a page turner, but this really is. But also actually in terms of the overall framework that you've got. And I think you absolutely do bring something new to the study of the film through this idea of disruption and the kind of the story of Empire Strikes Back being a story about disruption. You mentioned earlier, you know, viewing Star Wars in relation to things like production, distribution, technology. And I guess these themes are present in this book. So I wonder if you could sort of sketch out that idea of disruption and why Empire is a kind of a disruptive film.
Yeah, this came to me, actually it wasn't the framework through which I initially pitched the book. And it came to me a bit later when I was doing one of my many, many, many rewatches of the film. You get to a point where you think, I'm never going to see anything new in this. And then all of a sudden it hits you and you've seen it in a completely different way. So, I mean, narratively, it's obviously about disruption because the first film ends on the rebels at the medal ceremony and peace has been restored to the galaxy. And there's a new kind of equilibrium at the end. Obviously, Darth Vader has gone spinning off into space. At that point, you're meant to think that he has been defeated because the Death Star has been blown up and there's nothing left for him to come back to. So obviously, if you're going to do a sequel to a film like that, you have to disrupt the equilibrium and you have to shift things and twist it and blow the piece up again. So that, just in terms of its narrative, it's absolutely reliant on disruption. But I'm also a historian. So for me, it was about putting the film into its historical context. And thinking about the late 70s, so the film went into production in, I think it was March 79, if I remember correctly. But I think it was actually the premise of it was in underway in 78. So that kind of late 70s period through to 1980 when it comes out. There's so much going on around the film that's informing its story and its aesthetics. You have an election that's taking place in the UK while they're filming on location in England. There's the election in the US, which Reagan wins. So you've got this kind of shift to the right in politics going on in both the places where the film is being made. There's a huge amount of kind of social and cultural upheaval and turmoil still going on around gender and race and sexuality and issues of inequality in both in both North America and across Britain. There's all sorts going on with concerns about climate change, what we would now refer to as the climate emergency. So there's a lot going on that's quite disruptive and disorienting, I think, for people in their everyday lives. And you can absolutely see that throughout the film. It addresses quite a lot of these issues in implied ways, even if it's not doing it really explicitly. But also, I mean, just the aesthetics of the film, whereas in A New Hope, everything is very kind of flat and linear and at right angles, and it's quite slow and, you know, the camera moves from side to side and it moves up and down on two different axes. And it's quite a traditional kind of watch in some ways. But then you get Empire, which is just all over the, literally all over the place. And suddenly you're working on all of these different axes and planes. There are things at diagonals, there are canted screens, they are loops, the looping, then twisting from one side to the next. The characters are being thrown around everywhere. So just all the way through the film, like completely embedded in it, is disruption, divergence, and just a kind of audiovisual chaos at times.
Which I guess parallels the precisely the kind of social, political, cultural context that you've alluded to there. I'm really interested in why Empire matters, because I think in order to kind of understand Empire Strikes Back, you do have to know a bit about why Star Wars matters. And it seems like an absolutely bonkers question to be like, why does Star Wars matter when you've got, you know, this kind of billion-dollar franchise, its cultural importance, you know, its sort of position in shaping, I guess, a kind of a global culture that we have now. But I do think it is important that we do a bit of that kind of contextualization. So I love the line actually quite early on in the book where you pose this question about the way Star Wars came to acquire cultural capital. And it's strange really because, you know, in terms of, I guess, the position of the genre, in terms of its sort of status as a blockbuster, you know, the entire franchise is perceived very differently than it would have been, you know, previously in Hollywood. And we'll talk about things like the critics later. But I guess it would be kind of useful to hear a little bit about why Star Wars matters and within that, why Empire Strikes Back is a significant film.
I mean, in terms of why Star Wars matters, I guess the easy and obvious and yet also incredibly complicated answer is that it's because we've all made it matter. It's almost like a joint endeavor between the filmmakers, the distributors, the fans and the critics. Without all of us participating in creating Star Wars, it wouldn't matter. So I think we all play a role in that and ensuring that it's still relevant, whether that's through nostalgia for the older Star Wars films and texts or a kind of continued interest in the new ones that Disney are now making. I think, and certainly through the way that it acquired cultural capital, again, I think is around so many different people participating in processes just at the right time and in a particular context where it all just came together. So the role that George Lucas kind of played in the kind of, I guess, a movement, I don't know if I want to call it a movement, perhaps that's the right word for it, of New Hollywood. So the films that were coming out in the late 60s and through the 70s, by filmmakers, including Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, which were a kind of backlash against the studio system. And they were about a kind of an independent mode of filmmaking and production that gave more control to directors and producers and kind of bypassed the studio system and were responsible for some of the what we now think of as the most canonical films coming out of Hollywood in that period. And Lucas was obviously tangential to that, kind of aligned with them because he'd been working with Coppola, and his first feature film, THX, was kind of firmly in that mold. So he had that cultural cachet that he took into making this kind of bonkers blockbuster sci-fi Western space opera mashup. Which, I mean, now I think it's obviously really common for, you know, filmmakers with a certain level of esteem to be asked to go and make genre blockbuster films for big studios. And it's seen as a kind of natural move for them. But I don't think it was so common at that point in time. But I think it gave Star Wars the kudos of the association with New Hollywood and also Lucas's incredibly canny and smart move to merchandise the hell out of it. So it was, you know, suddenly you've got this thing, which is the branding of it. It was everywhere. And all the merchandise that went with that is in everyone's homes. It's on everyone's television set. It's on every poster. It's in all the department stores. So it acquires capital both in a material way and in this more conceptual way at the same time. And then Empire comes along, which really, on the face of things, should have failed, because at that point, I don't think there had really been that many instances of sequel films really doing that well. And certainly the expectation was that it would probably just be a remake of the first film, that it wouldn't do anything that exciting or new. And the studio, 20th Century Fox, the distributor, as well as, I think, you know, Lucas ended up putting a lot of his own money into the film. There was a lot of ambivalence about, you know, were they going to make the money back? Was it going to be a big flop? The fact that it was reasonably well received by critics and was so popular with fans, I think really established Star Wars as a, I'm now going to do a pun as well, a force to be reckoned with, although I didn't mean to. That was an unintended pun that I found myself coming up with there.
You structure the book, I guess, kind of chronologically, from that moment of introducing the franchise and why it matters, through production, through the content of the film, and then into questions of reception. And obviously production is one of those kind of key moments where your narrative of Empire as being disruptive kind of comes through. And it'd be great to hear a bit about, I guess, why the story of Empire's production is a story of disruption.
Yeah, so the production chapter was actually the one I struggled with the most, because while I was free to approach the film however I wanted, the series asks that you include certain information and cover certain topics, and the film's production is one of those things. And of course, there's just so much out there that's already been said about its production. So I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to uncover kind of big new stories. There's also, because the word count of the book is quite limited, they're, you know, short reads. So I thought, I can't go out and interview tons of creative talent involved in the film, because I simply won't have space to write up those interviews. And even the ones that are in there, there's very, very limited material, and I'll publish the rest in the next book. I was a bit worried about that production chapter, but actually, so what I've done is taken a kind of meta approach to analysing a lot of the existing narratives about it, because in turn I've tried to slightly disrupt those, because it turned out that the film's production history was, again, like a kind of chaotic. So much went wrong for them, and they were very, very clever, the PR people, about selling a story to the public that was one of overcoming challenges and difficulties and hurdles, which pointed to how absolutely committed the filmmakers were to the authenticity of the film and to serving the Star Wars fans. So some of the disruptions, they were filming in Finnsur in Norway, which I was fortunate enough to visit earlier in the year. And it's a glacier in the middle of nowhere. Well, it's not in the middle of nowhere, but it's very, very remote. One of the most remote places I've ever been. And when people tell you there's nothing there, they're not lying. You turn up and there is the train station platform, a tiny shop, and a hotel. And that's it for miles, miles and miles and miles. There's just snow, and it is very, very overwhelming to find yourself in that situation. And it happened that in the spring of 79, when they were filming, there were terrible, terrible storms that rendered the production almost immobile and unable to operate. So There are stories about members of the crew, including Harrison Ford, being stranded overnight in tiny railway stations and not being able to get to the location. Some days they couldn't go outside at all. There's the moment in the film when Luke is mauled by a Wampa on Hoth. They ended up filming literally just outside the back door of the hotel because they couldn't actually get outside enough in a whiteout to be able to shoot at the location that they'd found. So there's all of these kinds of stories. And then when they get to the shoot in the studio in England, they had a brand new purpose-built soundstage, which was at the time, I think, the biggest soundstage anywhere in the world. But that they actually, even then, they needed more space. The other soundstage that they were meant to be using had been damaged in a fire in the Kubrick film that was filming in there just before. So there were all of these delays. They ran way over budget. They were filming scenes backwards because parts of the set weren't finished each day. So it was just a kind of, sounded like a bit of a nightmare shoot from start to finish, which, yeah, they, now you'd think that you would kind of hide those problems that you were facing. And when films, I use the example of Solo, actually, the 2018 Star Wars film, you know, that had reshoots and change of director, or was it the script writers? And there was
director, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, they brought, was it Ron Howard came in to Disneyfy the film?
Yes, yeah. And yeah, I think there, around that there was lots of talk of disruption on the set and people not being happy. And so everyone anticipated that the film probably wouldn't be very good because of the production process. Whereas with Empire, they've really used it to their advantage to say, oh yeah, it was all disrupted, but that's part of the narrative of the film. Like, look at this amazing thing that we've achieved by overcoming these hurdles.
I mean, one element of your disruption frame goes to your own attempts to disrupt the common narratives of Star Wars. And with Empire, obviously, we're dealing with something that, you know, both in terms of control of the intellectual property, which, you know, we've seen in recent months discussions of Lucas's, you know, sort of alternative vision if the franchise hadn't been sold to Disney, but also in terms of, I guess, his indelible link with Star Wars. There is a kind of narrative of, you know, these are essentially kind of Lucas's babies, children, whatever sort of metaphor you'd want there. And this means that both, you know, the kind of broader assemblage of individuals, you know, maybe who are kind of crucial to the creative process gets maybe downplayed, erased or forgotten. But in particular, it means we miss really important narratives of gender in the production of Star Wars. And one of the things you do in that production chapter is to kind of highlight this. And it'd be good to maybe spend a little bit of time hearing about how you highlight that, because it's a theme that comes up later on in the book as well. So what's the sort of the gendered story of Empire's production?
I mean, to be honest, this is an area that I really wish, I mean, this could be a book on its own. And, you know, I had a couple of pages really to allude to some of these issues. I mean, the problem is just from start to finish, and this isn't just applicable to The Empire Strikes Back or to Star Wars. This is a problem throughout history, not just film, but one that we have to reckon with in doing film history and media history all the time, is the erasure from the historical record of the labor and creative input of marginalized people. So again, this isn't just it's not even just a woman problem. This is a problem of around race, around ethnicity, language, geography, all of these things. Certainly in the case of The Empire Strikes Back, all of the narratives in the mainstream, so in the popular press, in trade presses, and actually really for the most part in scholarship, And I'm saying this not with a view to not erasing the work that has been done by people of colour, by queer scholars and so on. But generally speaking, it's cis, white, straight men who have done this work and done the writing. And that's who they tend to focus their attention on. So women have been largely left out, even though there's lots of women's names in the credits for the film. So I was fortunate enough when I was in Norway, I met Madeline Most, who worked as a in the camera department on set. So I spent a few hours talking to her and hearing her story about what that was like. And it sounded, I mean, in some ways, sounded absolutely amazing. And she had a great time making both the first and the second Star Wars films. But also it was just, it sounded so hard being, you know, the only woman in your department, and the way that she had to adapt her behavior to kind of fit into that space, and some of the things that she had to put up with, and some of the language and abuse that was initially leveled at her. I wish I could be shocked by it, and I wish I could think that that doesn't still happen today, which neither, unfortunately, is the case. But I also, I mean, I heard some really great stories as well. It's noticeable that there are, in a few cases, every now and then you find evidence of men who worked on the production really bigging up one of their women colleagues. So for example, on location in Norway, there was a helicopter crew who were working with really like high level specialist adapted specifically for this film kind of equipment to get the aerial shots that were then part of the compositing process with the ATATs and the live footage added in. And he writes about Margaret Heron, who was the camera assistant in the helicopter. And she was doing this like astonishing, phenomenal work and was, you know, making a major contribution to what we see on the screen in this film. But it, trying to find interviews with her is impossible. Like I certainly online at least, I can't find anything. So yeah, I think one of the next things to do with the bigger book is to try to find people to interview and to fill in some of the gaps of these stories. And it's worth mentioning as well that actually there is a project by Amy Richaud in the US. She runs a blog called 365 Days of Star Wars Women, which has like just an enormous repository of information about the women that have worked across the franchise. And that does include quite a lot of interviews with the women who are still alive to be able to tell their stories. So that's worth checking out if you're interested in following up on issues of gender in the franchise.
We can extend this into the film itself, and I guess the kind of the representations that are in the film. We've got, you know, challenges to what we think of as a kind of conventional hero in the film, with obviously, you know, the kind of powerful character that is Yoda, but also you try and get to grips with the way things like gender, sexuality, race both come together in particular characters like Lando, but also again, you know, you continue this slightly disruptive theme. And picking up on what you were saying, not just about women's erasure from the production process, but it'd be interesting to hear how you kind of extended or continued discussions around gender, sexuality, and race when you're thinking about the representations that are actually on screen in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was the most fun chapter to write, because it was the one where I just got to go to town with, you know, what I position all the way through. This is part of doing revisionist work, is coming to something with a different set of values or a different perspective. And I've tried to be really open and clear about what my perspective is and what I am bringing to the film. So yeah, this was the point when I just got to go wild, really. In terms of gender, I think the most important thing for me in terms of thinking about representation was to do this from an intersectional point of view and not to just say, this is a good film because it has a strong woman, or this is a bad film because there's only one woman and that, you know, it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. So, for example, there isn't another woman with for Leia to have a conversation with. I feel like those kinds of ways of looking at things can be quite reductive. So I wanted to allow it to be complicated and to allow it to have flaws and to have ideological issues and things that I don't necessarily agree with, even though I love the film. So I, in looking at Leia in particular, it was important to me to see her, you know, to think about this as a character who is not just a woman. She's also white, and she is also a princess and a senator who has come from an elite, upper class, moneyed background and wields an enormous amount of power within the rebellion. And so looking at her from that point of view, I found more kind of useful in terms of positioning the film, again, like in a historical context. These things are quite, there are connections there between Leia and white second wave feminism around the same period. And some of the things that she says in terms of, I mean, things that we find really funny, they are jokes and they are meant to be about Leia asserting her power or to retrieve power in instances where men are taking it away from her. You know, she calls Han a scruffy looking nerf herder, for example. But if we, I mean, some people might feel like, okay, this is, you know, maybe you're going a bit far here. But if we think about that in the context of a real world situation, she's insulting him based on labor and class, which makes sense because she's a princess. But, you know, that isn't a feminist thing to do, for example. So in looking at race and sexuality, again, it was about doing the same thing, being critical of the way that the film positions Lando as the only black man in the film and in Star Wars up to that point. There are certainly racist tropes and conventions that it's heavily reliant on. But at the same time, it's demonstrating, you know, that it's a black man in a position of power. It's a black man who is demonstrating an enormous amount of care for his friends. So I just, yeah, as I said, trying to get some of the kind of complicated nuances within the film that I think you can certainly, without having to, you know, without really paying attention to it, find it quite easy to miss.
How was it received? And I guess there are multiple audiences for any cultural text, but I guess the kind of closing chapters of the book, you think through the reception from fans, both, you know, then and now, but also in terms of critics. So what did the fans think and what did the critics say?
I think the fans were already geared up to love it before it even hit the screen on the day that it premiered. So there were fans queuing for 3 days outside cinemas in LA. I'm not sure if people were quite so invested in the UK, but then the weather isn't really conducive to camping outside a cinema for 3 days in London. So I don't blame them. But there were definitely, you know, there was a huge amount of hype. There had been an enormous publicity campaign with the stars being taken on a kind of PR tour all around Europe, Australia, Japan, you know, all across the US. So I think, it, you know, it was always going to be a hit with the people that loved Star Wars. And it did enormously well at the box office. Its initial box office takings were much, much higher than Star Wars, although it didn't eclipse it entirely over a longer period of time. And it seems like the reception was pretty good among fans. I interviewed Terry Hardin, who was a kind of super fan and was quite famous at the time. She was at the front of the queue at the Chinese Theatre in LA, was interviewed a lot by the press. she had, I think she kind of unofficially held the record for seeing Star Wars the most number of times when it first came out. And yeah, she describes everyone being elated, people cheering, the kind of the big moment with the I am your father reveal, like sent everyone into, you know, again, cheering, clapping. So it sounds like everyone had a great time. The critics were a bit more mixed, I think for a variety of reasons, but largely to do with the film's blockbuster status. And although it had these kind of art film and actually like really kind of camp melodramatic antecedents and aesthetics, I think critics, you can almost sense that they don't know quite what to do with it. They want to say nice things about it, but they also feel, you know, they're still saying, oh, but it's a blockbuster. It's a family film. It's mass entertainment. This film is guaranteed to make money, whatever we say about it. And so you can sense that it, like, again, it's disruptive. It disrupts critics' notions of what good cinema is according to these hierarchies of taste.
It's sort of a strange thing to, as you round off the book and we're going to round off the conversation, to talk about there being multiple Empire Strikes Back. But I think it is important, I guess, to kind of to grapple with that this is a film that, as well as having these, you know, kind of multiple receptions with different audiences, fan groups, critics, both, you know, then and kind of, you know, critical canonization as we get towards the present. But it's also something that, you know, Lucas has fiddled about with. You know, there are kind of changes to all three of the original trilogy, some of which, you know, fans were kind of really unhappy with, some of which had, you know, really major implications for how characters are seen, such as Han not firing first in A New Hope, these kinds of things. And yet Empire seemed to be the one that I suppose was kind of least messed about with, or if I was going to use a stronger term, was kind of, you know, least sort of ruined by Lucas's messing about. And I guess it's sort of interesting to hear about the sort of the multiple textual nature of this film. You know, is it right to say that there is a kind of an Empire Strikes Back, or are we dealing with multiple versions, you know, some of which are kind of purer and others of which have maybe been, you know, changed, damaged, ruined, made better even?
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely fair to say that there are multiple The Empire Strikes Backs. And I mean, to be honest, with any film, you know, the formatting, the colour grading, all of these things will change from the theatrical release print of a film to, or if it's on DCP, like the digital cinema package, which is the format most common in cinemas, and the home viewing, they're always going to be different and there will always be changes. So actually, when we talk about a film, we tend to be masking the fact that we're talking about multiple versions of it in the first place. But yeah, certainly with the Star Wars films, there are so many different iterations of them. I actually had to write a kind of foreword to the book to explain this and to explain which edition of the film I was actually referring to throughout the book. Because I'm trying to locate it in the 80s, I've used the version that's closest to what people would have seen in the theatres in 1980. But even that, you know, that's a scan of a home viewing print of the theatrical release, which has been put out on DVD, but it's not the official DVD format for that film, which, as you say, has been remastered and digitized by Lucas in the, I think it was in the late 90s that happened. Episode 4 and episode 6, so either side of Empire, had fairly substantial narrative elements changed. They've had sequences added in, fans will immediately recognize the Han shot first drama from the original Star Wars film, where Han is in a cantina and shoots this other bounty hunter in cold blood. He just shoots him without any kind of violent provocation on the other side. And Lucas changed that so that the other bounty hunter shot at him first in the later edition. So there's these all sorts of changes, but Empire doesn't get changed like that. And although it has lots of new shots added, they are mostly just to clean up the visual effects that were not quite right. So it was mostly about tweaking things. And there aren't any substantial narrative or dialogue changes. So I think people end up seeing even these later editions of Empire, they see them as more authentic and closer to the original text than perhaps the other films are.
You mentioned you're working on a much bigger Star Wars project. I'm interested to sort of wrap up and conclude with where Empire relates to that, actually. And what do you think is its position, not just with the other Nile 8 films and the triple trilogy it's part of, but also in terms of where we are with this kind of sprawling and multiple Star Wars universe of books, some of which are canon, some of which aren't, television series, animated series, non-trilogy films, stuff like this. Is it just a matter of Empire just being, you know, the kind of most significant, most important, or actually should we just view it, I guess, as one part of this larger cultural phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, this is, for me, it was a really, really interesting moment to get to write about Empire, because I suspect that whereas now it holds this position as being, you know, the favorite Star Wars film. Almost every single list that you look at, every single poll, every single critics list, it's always, you know, the best out of the films in the franchise. But we are just shifting into a moment where the people who are becoming or are about to become critics, academics, filmmakers, people who have authority in the public sphere to determine taste, they are of an age where the prequels were actually their first encounter with Star Wars, and they saw those often before seeing the original trilogy. And whereas the prequels are derided actually by a lot of people from my generation and back, the students that I teach now who want to write dissertations about Star Wars, they love the prequels and think they're brilliant, and they have a completely different notion of what authenticity means in the Star Wars universe because that's their first encounter with it. So I think that actually writing this book might be in the dying moment of Empire being the favorite film, and its status within the franchise might change as new voices and new perspectives come along with a completely different way of encountering these films.